ACDC Beyond the Thunder, the podcast that's dirty, mean, and mighty unclean. With your thunderous hosts, Kurt Squires, Greg Ferguson, and Eric Cube. Are you ready?
Ayo, and top of the podcast to your listeners. We're shipping up to Boston for a very special St. Paddy's Day celebration with a band that best represents this holiday like no other, the Dropkick Murphys, an American band formed in Quincy, Mass., whose founder once said, "I think our goal is to be the AC/DC of Celtic punk rock." That's a goal that I think we can truly rally behind, especially since this very podcast, AC/DC Beyond the Thunder, is all about how well-known fans have been influenced by this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band in truly remarkable ways. I'm your host, Kurt Squires, with my brethren brothers, engineer Eric Kielb, and me other lucky charm, Mr. Greg Ferguson.
Hey, Eric. Hey, Kurt. How's she cutting?
Hello, lad.
Well, that's right. As you mentioned, we're sitting down with one of Dropkick Murphy's most veteran bandmates who, outside of singer bassist Ken Casey, has been the longest tenured bandmate and has not missed a single gig behind a drum kit since he joined the band in 1997.
Wow.
The Invincible, Matt Kelly.
Well, he's like the Cal Ripken Jr. of drummers, never missing that many years of drumming. That's insane.
Unbelievable.
Well, in fact, we found out that Matt is originally from Leominster, Massachusetts, and I only know how to pronounce that because I went to design school at Fitchburg State University, right next door. So if you're a local, it's technically pronounced Leominster.
Well, yeah. And of course, that's located right next to Wooster. And that's, you know, where both of us saw AC/DC play for the first time.
That's right. Worcester had all the heavy metal gigs.
They did. The Worcester Centrum.
What a gig. And Matt, too, was probably there. He's a tremendous AC/DC fan, which we're about to discuss as we speak. But before we do, we wanted to give props to Boston's Greg the Hillman Hill, who's a Boston radio personality, who we were interviewing and was the one who actually pulled us aside and said, "You know who you guys have to interview while you're in town? Hands down, the biggest AC/DC fans I've ever met." He said the Dropkick Murphys.
That's right. And since the band was not all in one place and we had to catch another flight, we asked the Hillman if he had to choose just one of the guys from the Dropkick Murphys to interview, who would be the ultimate AC/DC fan and who would he choose? And that guy was the drummer of the Dropkick Murphys, Matt Kelly.
Matt Kelly. Actually, Eric, if you could do us a favor, can you cue up a snippet from that interview with Greg Hill?
Yeah, I mean, here in Boston, people love real rock and roll, and they like, you know, they like to drink a lot. They like drinking songs. They like a band that isn't pretentious. And when AC/DC comes and they play The Garden, it's, you know, go out 3 hours beforehand, and then go out afterwards. You know, and it's, I think the biggest compliment that AC/DC could get is that, you know, one of the best punk bands that we have in Boston, the Dropkick Murphys, covered, it's a long way to the top. You know, you don't get, when a punk band wants to go out and cover a hard rock tune, you know that you've hit home, you know? And so I think they mean, short of Aerosmith, because they're from here, I think they're just a giant band in Boston.
Yeah, the Hillman had some great memories about AC/DC coming to Massachusetts.
Love that.
From introducing them on stage at the Boston Garden, yeah, to giving away SGs that were signed by the band. Just really, really fun memories throughout the years with the Hillman. But he was also gracious enough to put us in touch with Matt. And Matt wanted us to meet him at their practice space, which was located in, was it Quincy?
I think it might have been. It was a little sketchy.
Yeah, and I remember walking in and Matt's there sitting behind his drum kit, and you know, the first thing he did is he just kind of proudly pulled up his sleeve and showed us his TNT tattoo. Super cool.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Little TNT, old school colored in tattoo. Yeah, and one of my favorite memories was after interviewing Matt, was getting to play a little What Do You Do For Money, Honey? With him. I was on acoustic guitar, which is funny, playing AC/DC, and Matt was wailing away on his drum kit. What a fun moment, and such a nice guy.
Yeah, he's such a nice guy. I did enjoy that moment. I can't remember if we actually recorded that or not, but I know we have some photos from that interview we did with Matt. So really, yeah. Really good memories. Really nice guy. Such a cool band. You know, they're politically active. They support the unions. They support the middle class. They're, you know, an extremely charitable group of guys, and they lend tons of support to military veterans.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Very excited for our listeners to dig in, get to know the band, get to know Matt in this episode.
Okay, folks, it's time to break out the corned beef and dark stout, because today's episode features a drummer who began bashing the Skins at the age of 8 years old. And eventually, as you know, joined a band named after Dr. John Dropkick Murphy's alcohol detoxification facility. I actually didn't know that. They are synonymous with the beloved Red Sox and the city of Boston, where their music featured in films such as The Departed, The Fighter, and Fever Pitch. Now on the road for their St. Patrick's Day tour, AC/DC Beyond the Thunder welcomes the Dropkick Murphy's own Matt Kelly. Matt, thank you so much for being here and taking a part of AC/DC Beyond the Thunder. Both Greg and I grew up in New England, so we're very familiar with the Dropkicks and their formation. Was that around the mid-90s or so?
Since 1996, okay. January 96.
And because the Dropkick Murphys encompass such a diverse group of musicians with many different influences, how did the band finally land on a common sound that you could all agree upon? Because, well, let's face it, there's tons of bands that you guys love, but what is the one key band that you guys sort of said, okay, this is the one we agree on?
I think driving around in the early days, it was, you know, among other more contemporary bands like Swingin' Utters and, you know, and then bands like The Clash and Stiff Little Fingers,
yeah,
the Pogues, there was AC/DC. It's a no-brainer. I mean, it's just pure, like, distilled rock and roll. And if you don't like AC/DC, you probably shouldn't be playing music, you know.
Well, that's the soundbite we're looking for, Greg. Thanks, Matt. I think our work is done here.
Come on.
That is an awesome way to begin an interview. But seriously, when we're talking about roots, there's an interesting dynamic between AC/DC's roots, which truly begins in their native Scotland prior to moving to Australia.
Yeah.
But Boston also has some very strong roots in the UK, and your band harnesses that same sound of hard rock, punk, tough rock and roll with some traditional instrumentation thrown in there for good measure. Where does that come from? And two, how can you compare a band like Dropkicks and AC/DC?
I think, you know, a lot of us grew up with like Irish music in the home and this and that. And then, I mean, my dad plays drums. A lot of the guys in the band, I mean, James, our guitarist's dad, was an old punk rocker. He used to go see bands at the Ratskeller back in the mid-70s, him and his mom. And he and his wife, James's mom, used to go see bands back then. And I think just like a thirst for like no frills rock is I guess across the board, like all the guys in the band, because you know you grew up in kind of working class families, and that's, I think AC/DC has a big, the big blue collar following, like, mm-hmm, in all over the country and all over the world, because it's like a no BS kind of sound.
And, right.
You know, you don't look at these people like, oh, these are kind of dudes I want to beat up, because, you know, they got freaking big teased hair, or like, you know, it's just straight up music. And I would like to think and hope that, like, that's the same kind of thing we have going on. We're just a bunch of regular guys who come up from, you know, kind of basically working class backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what drew us to AC/DC, but that might be a parallel. If you know Boston, and you've been to Boston, you realize the pride of place, pride of where you come from, pride in your roots.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when you see like AC/DC, you know, with their, I remember seeing footage of them with like, they're all wearing the Scottish national team soccer shirts or
yes,
football shirts, whatever. You know, I guess there's a parallel there, because I mean, we're definitely proud of where we come from and who we are.
Know that it took years and years of touring for AC/DC to reach global domination. What was the first moment where you felt that the Dropkicks were finally beginning to gain traction, Matt?
I mean, for the longest time, we were pretty under the radar, you know. I think 2004, when we were asked by the Red Sox to rewrite the anthem from 100 years ago, they gave us the honor of playing in Fenway Park, being kind of involved with the Red Sox, kind of an unofficial anthem, the song Tessie. That kind of opened a lot of people's eyes to us, a lot of local people. Because before that, I mean, you know, people may have heard of us, or they might have, you know, they might have heard rumor of us or something, but I think that we got thrust into the local public eye around 2004. I mean, we'd done stuff with the Boston Bruins, and that definitely helped. But the Sox thing really, really blew us up.
Yeah.
I think people, you know, and then we were also in the movie The Departed. We had a song in there, I'm Shipping Up to Boston.
Yes.
And that was in a lot of key moments in the movie. So I think nowadays people think of us as like maybe... ambassadors of Boston. I don't know, I don't want to sound like a jerk here, you know, it's like some kind of pompous prick, you know, patting myself on the shoulder, but you know, I think some people might think of us as a good representation of Boston. Some maybe more uppity people might think we're a bad representation of Boston, because we represent, you know, the lower middle classes and the working man, the everyman, you know. So as far as AC/DC their representation to the world, I think they represent everything good about rock and roll and all the timelessness of rock and roll, but still remaining relevant and modern. And you know, every album that comes out, it's, you know, people are gagging for it, getting ready for it, and you know, it finally comes out, and you know, it's another classic in their huge catalog of, in my eyes, perfect records.
Well said, Matt. Well said. Quintessential Dropkick Murphys, Shipping Up to Boston, a song that Greg and I actually pitched and presented to Sam Adams to use as their TV campaign, and they successfully used for years. Great pairing of band and brand. Not to mention, as you said, The Departed, where a lot of people were first exposed to Dropkicks through that song. Leo loved it. Martin Scorsese loved it. Robbie Robertson loved it. Kudos to you for landing such a high-profile song for many uses. But Matt, tell us about where your affinity for AC/DC started. Maybe the first time you heard the band's name, or even the first album you purchased for yourself, just to get a sense of where you entered into AC/DC's career.
The first AC/DC record I got was Flick of the Switch.
Nice.
When I was a kid. I forget how old I was. I think I did one of those, like, you know, buy 12 records for a penny kind of thing, and have to buy one at full price later on. It was the greatest deal in the world for, you know, kind of, you know, not exactly a rich kid growing up. So
yeah.
Yeah, I got that. And I think the next record I got was, I got 74 Jailbreak.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, there's a different singer. Weird, you know? And that was, you know, obviously some of their earliest stuff with Bon. And I really dug that. And I just, you know, me and, you know, myself and like a lot of my friends in school, you know, you're wearing school uniforms, you're in a Catholic elementary school, and you kind of want to, I guess you want to rebel, or you want to do stuff as differently and do your own thing as much as possible, because everything this everything's so strict and structured. So I think that really kind of, my buddies and I got into AC/DC. And
Let me interrupt you for a second. You brought up something, you hit upon something amazing that I'd never thought about before, when you mentioned the schoolboy uniform you had to wear. Do you think Angus Young wearing his schoolboy uniform was not only just a fun stage gimmick, but perhaps a huge middle finger to school or education in general?
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, wearing the uniform is definitely a calculated move. Because I mean, you know, I know a lot of, you know, a lot of people writing about them say that, like, you know, he came right from school to the stage or whatever. I mean, that wasn't true. You know, it was a calculated move. And it helped personify the whole like spirit of AC/DC. You know, it's like the little kid freaking running down the street, you know, coming back from sneaking out of class and like, you know, lighting the cat's tail on fire or something like that, or you know, because I know he was a little troublemaker. He was the head of a little gang of miscreants back then when he was Angus when he was a little guy.
Yeah.
I think it was almost the whole uniform thing was a personification of the mischief. You know, he has a halo and a set of horns over his head. You know what I mean? You think, oh, what a nice little guy. You know, nice little kid in his uniform. You know, going off to school, probably going to do his homework, or he's playing guitar and. You know, getting cheeky with the girls, you know?
Yeah, he fooled everyone, for sure. And now, as Dee Snider told us, he's just going to be an old man in short pants. So getting back to the roots of where your obsession with AC/DC started, which you said was Flick of the Switch, the very first album that you purchased for yourself.
Yeah.
And the killer Columbia House record deal, which I also loved. But tell us about the first time you heard AC/DC. Where were you? Describe how that music potentially, it seems like, changed your life that day.
The first time I heard AC/DC, I believe I was riding in the car with my dad. And like everything, like a little kid, I was probably like 6 or 7 maybe. And I was always into music because my dad plays. I mean, we're always seeing bands. I think we were driving around in the car, and I was asked my dad, who's this, you know? I want to say it was Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap.
Okay.
Who's this? It's AC/DC. I was like, all right, cool. Put that up in the mental filing cabinet, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, as a little kid, I mean, you're a little more susceptible I think music moves kids a lot more because they don't have so many taboos and preconceived like ways you should act and shouldn't act, and it just hit me in a very primal way.
Yeah.
Hard tune, and it's just with the floor tom and the guitar ringing in there,
right,
in the beginning, this is a long time ago, but I think I was just thinking that it's mean, and I liked that. And I think that it might have warped my mind from that day on. You got a lover and you want to go on, but you ain't got the guts. You keep standing you night and day. Stuff is right, you know.
That's a rare live version of AC/DC's Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, featuring the mighty Phil Rudd. Okay, here's a question. I don't get to ask too many guests, but I'm curious, because you're a drummer, if you had to pick one band member from AC/DC who influenced you most as a musician, who would it be? I'm guessing Phil Rudd?
Funnily enough, I'm a drummer, but my favorite instrument is the guitar. Don't know how that worked out.
Huh.
But I think it was Malcolm.
Wow.
Especially later on, knowing how much of a role he's played in the band.
Right.
He just sits in the background and kind of does a shuffle thing, you know? But the guy's a genius, you know? He just knew how to work things out. And as far as on my drumming, Phil Rudd is one of my... I think the guy, again, with AC/DC, cutting out all the BS, he's just laying it forward on the floor and throwing in a cool fill now and then, which it's sometimes what you don't play that makes it that good.
Right.
Because, you can have a guy busy and throwing fills in left and right. Rudd's just laying it down, and then he plays just what he's supposed to play, and that's genius. That you can't teach that or be taught that. You have to I don't know, it's just like a soul thing.
Yeah, it's funny, and everyone says that, and I totally agree. Rudd is a minimalist player, but I also remember growing up listening to AC/DC during the Mutt Lang production days, even Flick of the Switch, like you mentioned, and it seemed like Phil was hitting the cymbals every 3 seconds or so, which I kind of loved.
Well, especially towards the end of a song, like he knew how to, he kind of turns up and down the intensity. You know, he'll just maybe during a verse, he'll just be laying it down. But then, like, you know, you get towards the end, you're doing like either a bridge, you're doing like a, you know, reprise or something. Comes back and just hitting those cymbals on the backbeat, and it just, and then doubling them up. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's as simple as it gets, but it makes it so much more intense.
Yeah.
And it's other people will be doing all these crazy fills and you know, distracting from just the power of the song, and he's just enhancing the song, you know, and that's just genius.
Yeah. And you take another band like The Who, and you have four guys who are essentially all playing lead instruments, crazy drums, amazing virtuoso bass player, screaming vocals, and this visceral guitar, destroying guitar player, Pete Townsend, all competing with each other. And then you have AC/DC, who are just playing within the pocket, right?
It's, yeah, you're right. And like, it's funny, I think The Who was a huge influence on Angus, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Including the intense showmanship of Pete Townsend. Plus he also played the Gibson SG. So
it's a funny thing. Who's one of my favorite bands too, in a weird way. It's they're almost like diametrically opposite from AC/DC, because AC/DC is about restraint and like anger just bubbling under the surface.
Yeah, totally. Definitely influenced from The Who, Chuck Berry, B.B. King, absolutely The Stones. Those guys were a part of AC/DC's blueprint, but who else would you throw in that mix?
It's a little Richard. It's you know, Screaming Lord Sutch.
Oh.
It's Stones. It's rock and roll, but without any of the we won't find an AC/DC ballad. You know, the closest thing you got is Ride On, and that's gonna be played at my wake.
Oh, cool.
Because that's an awesome song, and it means a lot, especially for somebody being on the road a lot.
Yeah.
But you know, they just cut all the crap out of rock and roll and just made the perfect vehicle for it. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, any of the early rock and roll, kind of probably amphetamine-driven rock and roll stuff of the 50s and stuff. You know, even Wynonie Harris.
Yeah.
I guess he was the 40s, but he if you listen to his stuff, it may as well have been the 50s, because I think he influenced a bunch of bands that I think in turn influenced AC/DC.
True.
Of course, you know, I'm sure George Young was huge influence on his brothers, because you know, he had the easy beats, he had the success, and I know he was very instrumental in some of the early stuff, and he'd always play their songs on the piano to make sure they're musically made sense, and they all do. So
yeah,
I guess, you know, Lobby Lloyd, in Australia in the 60s and 70s, you know, he had so many good bands going on, so it's. I think they came from a long line of, you know, rockers. I mean, you know, like you said, like I was talking about earlier, the stock of grandchildren and you know, great great grandchildren of criminals. I think it just has that sort of like rebellious spirit in there. I think there was a whole scene of the whole rock. I think rock and roll just really took off in Australia because of that.
Wow.
Because it's just in that kind of in their blood.
Yeah. Well, that's an awesome little laundry list, Matt, of some influence. Very cool. And speaking of being out on the road and choosing Ride On as your funeral song, which is amazing, you've had the chance to bump into many heroes, including Bruce Springsteen, and you've toured the world over. Have you ever had a chance to run into AC/DC and meet the boys?
Never met them. Oh, geez, I never met the guys. Yeah. They say you never meet your idols, you know. But me and the guys at Soundcheck will probably, you know, play half of Power Age, playing it on stage.
Wow.
Just because, I mean, everybody in our band worships AC/DC.
That album is something else, isn't it? It's really the last true AC/DC album before the record label injected steroids into the band, right?
That's Power Age is the AC/DC fans' album. You know, like if you're a huge huge AC/DC fan, I don't know, like so many of my friends who are just, you know, Boston is a bastion of AC/DC support. Always has been.
Yeah.
Any of my friends who are like big AC/DC heads, everybody agrees that Power Age is just like something happened on that record. It's perfect.
Yeah, that album is absolutely timeless. And speaking of playing covers, let's talk about cover bands, or tribute bands, I should call them. We've interviewed several here on AC/DC Beyond the Thunder, and there are hundreds around the globe, believe us. Do you have a favorite tribute band of AC/DC?
Well, there's a band that, an AC/DC tribute band, or cover band, I should say. They're not around anymore, fortunately. They're called Beefy DC.
Beefy DC.
The singer, Beefy, very, very largely proportioned gentleman, but he could... You close your eyes, and like depending on the song, you sound just like Bon and just like Brian.
Wow.
Unbelievable. I mean, the guy's obviously a huge fan. And I had Billy Close from the Freeze fame, from the Freeze on, he was doing the Malcolm. You know, and these guys, they didn't look like AC/DC, but they you could tell they're just dudes who loved AC/DC. And they sounded just phenomenal. Choice of covers too. They do stuff like Riff Raff
Nice. Speaking of covers, Dropkick Murphys do a lot of fun AC/DC cover songs. Do you have any stories behind why you chose those particular songs, and how those get incorporated into your live sets?
Dropkicks have done a few AC/DC covers since the very early days. I think the first cover we did was TNT. And we have a song, Skinhead on the MBTA, and we kind of have a breakdown in the middle, which is like floor tom and just kind of ringing, letting the guitars ring. And it's in A, so to drop down to E is it's not clashing. And we just bust into TNT, and people, okay, this isn't how their song goes. What's this? Then you hear the guitar riff come in, like, yeah, you know, and it worked to great effect, you know, because by that point, people are all at the stage going bananas, and then, you know, sing along with TNT. It's like, oh, cool.
Hey, AC/DC Beyond the Thunder podcast listeners. As you know, the show is free, so please consider supporting the Nordoff Robbins Music Therapy and Make-A-Wish Foundations. Those are our two favorite charities. What we're doing here, our time and expenses are free, and we take your donations and directly deposit to those deserving causes. So right after the show, simply go to beyondthethunder.com, hit the charity button, and donate as little as $1. And we may just call your name out on the show, like Peter Pish, Kyle Hildreth, Sean McDuff, Remy Andre Onvik, Mark Johansson, and Candace Hickman. Greg, Eric, and I salute you in the AC/DC Beyond the Thunder community for leaning in. That's beyondthethunder.com. Hit the charity button and donate. Thanks so much. Matt, tell us about your biggest AC/DC cover song.
We started covering It's a Long Way to the Top, If You Want to Rock and Roll. I guess it's sort of a no-brainer for us because we have bagpipes in our band.
Yes.
And we draw great influence from AC/DC, always have. So I think it was just, I guess, a matter of time before we got our act together and covered It's a Long Way.
Sure.
Because early on in when we just started, people said that we sounded like a mix between like the Ramones, the Pogues, and AC/DC because of like our sound.
Yeah.
You know, bagpipes, this and that. And like we had flirted in the beginning with bagpipes. With a couple bits of songs and stuff, but later on we actually got a full-time bagpipe player. So we're like, well, we got to do this, you know.
Yeah.
We went in the studio during our blackout sessions, and we actually had a picture of Bon up there for inspiration. You know, so we didn't stray too far from the original.
Yeah.
And we just busted the song out because I mean, and I think it came out pretty well. You know, I'm no Phil Rudd, but. I try to just lay it down like he does, and we just all the little nuances of that song. It's like it sounds like just totally straightforward, but there's a lot of cool guitar nuance going on, slight picking changes, and
yes,
when you really, I guess, dissect the song, it's just an amazing tune, you know.
It really is.
So yeah, so we put that out, and gets a bit of radio play around here in Boston and around. So it's I guess people dig it, you know.
So good. That might very well be the most loved and most covered AC/DC song, especially the people we've talked to, including everyone from Lemmy to Pat Boone to Lucinda Williams. We even interviewed the Wiggles, who performed a live version of A Long Way to the Top for us.
Children's show?
Yes, exactly.
Really?
Yes, really.
Yeah, that's because that's how we learned about the Wiggles from our manager, I want to say.
Yeah, also fellow Australians. They all got in their little red car and performed the entire song for us.
That's cool, man.
You know.
That's crazy.
And then, obviously, another fun cover was done by Jack Black in School of Rock.
Can we play with Tenacious D at Reading?
Really?
They didn't do that. I don't remember. Fuck. This was a... It's, yeah, I mean, you can tell he has a huge appreciation for AC/DC.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think he actually wrote that he wanted more AC/DC in the film, which is great. We need to get him on the show, so. But by the way, when was the first time you saw AC/DC live? You mentioned hearing them for the first time, but tell us where you saw them, who you went with, and how that affected your life.
Yeah, I saw them in, I think, 87 or 88, Blow Up Your Video Tour.
Oh, like, cool.
My poor dad. I was probably 12 or 13, you know, so my dad went with me, you know. Yeah, you know, my dad's a rock and roll guy. He grew up, he played in bands around Boston, you know, around like Massachusetts and stuff. And, you know, he was into the Barbarians and the Kinks and all that stuff. And you know, he had, you know, like I had said, he's like, you know, when I was, he told me who AC/DC was when we were listening to the radio. But, you know, I don't think he was the biggest fan. We went to the show at the Worcester Centrum. And afterwards, he's like, you know, I loved that. That was amazing. I really enjoyed that. He's like, he's like, I thought there was some heavy metal thing. He's like, they're just a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
Blown away that was still happening, you know, just like straight up rock and roll.
Sure.
Because that's what, you know, he was always into, like a lot of the British Invasion bands.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, they took a cue from a lot of those bands musically.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you look at The Who, I mean, you know, Daltrey was, you know, he's a tough guy, and you know, those, they were a bunch of animals, and I think he saw that was AC/DC was a, you know, in the same, from the same lineage, you know, from the same bloodline in a way, as far as music goes, and I was really shocked that he liked it, ever since, you know, he has some of their albums and stuff, and it's pretty cool. It's something we definitely we agree on a lot of stuff. It's something a little closer to heart for me, because I mean, AC/DC is my favorite band in the world.
Ours too, Matt. Ours too. Wow, that's really a special thing to connect with your dad over, especially such a hard-driving band like AC/DC. And I honestly think my dad wanted to kill me whenever I played AC/DC in the house, specifically the song Flick of the Switch, which I played ad nauseum against my father's wishes. So he can still hum that song to this day, I guarantee it. Well, Matt, thank you so much for sitting here at your drum kit today, talking shop with us.
Oh, thanks.
Learning all there is to learn about this truly influential band. But most of all, thanks for being a part of AC/DC Beyond the Thunder on such short notice. But we must leave you with the final question of the day, which is, after trying to distill AC/DC down to the very essence through our discussion today, can you serve up one single word that best describes this mighty thing called AC/DC?
If I had to describe AC/DC in one word, tough. I think that says everything about them. There's not one bit of the band's fiber that's pansy. You know, they're just tough.
AC/DC Beyond the Thunder theme song, Trailer Trash, written and performed by Gannon Arnold. VO talent by Bruce Jacobson. Cinematography and sound recording by Greg Ferguson. Edited and mixed by Eric Keel. Written, directed, and hosted by Kurt Squires. Produced by Greg Ferguson, Eric Keel, and Kurt Squires. AC/DC Beyond the Thunder is a Squires LLC Current Motion production. Copyright Beyond the Thunder podcast, all rights reserved. This has been a Nat Attack presentation.
Jazz Bot Nanu Nanu.